welcome to The Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Powell. Today, our episode will be the first one recorded virtually as we work to be able to have discussions with subject matter experts across the globe. As we continue to grow, we strive to provide you with top quality episodes each week. This week, it's time to focus on everyone's favorite topic, property. Now, we could talk about property in a multitude of different ways, and we'll most likely have future episodes discussing the different aspects of it. However, today we're going to talk about the extra container you have on your books, the trailer that has no truck to pull it, or the pile of outdated equipment that you no longer have use for. Yes, I'm talking about the excess. What do we do with all this excess that's taking up pages on one's property book and wasting so much time inventorying when we never use it? It can be extremely bad when you see equipment on either your property book or just laying around the motor pool that's been out of service since the 80s, for instance. You would think we would have won this war on excess by now. However, we are still overcoming property issues till this day. The Army response has utilized the Modernization, Displacement, and Repair Sites, MDRS, and Rapid Removal of Excess, R2E programs to help solve this issue. However, they've even faced their own challenges in this war on excess. To walk us through MDRS, R2E, and the overall situation of this war on excess, I have with me today Major Jonathan Shackelford, who just recently served as a theater logistics planner in a SPO shop as the MDRS and R2E lead for Army Sustainment Command. He has worked with HQDA, ForceCom, and USERPAC on multiple projects, issues, and future plans for Class 7 in a time of great reform with property. He is an East Tennessee native who attended East Tennessee State University studying manufacturing engineering technology. He entered active duty in January of 2016 after completing Quartermaster Bullock. During his lieutenant years, he served with the 4th Infantry Division, where he deployed in support of DISCA in the Virgin Islands and OIR in Syria. Following his FSC command in the 1st Armored Division, he completed the CASCOM-sponsored Virginia Commonwealth University Master's in Supply Chain Management program. Having firsthand experience with MDRS and R2E, he's a person to walk us through this war on excess. So happy to have you on the show today, sir. Welcome.
Hey, happy to be here.
So we want to kind of get on in, because I know we could spend hours talking about this topic on property and the war on excess. So to kind of start us off, can you kind of walk our guests through, our audience through, the story behind the war on excess and what this turn-in process is like?
Absolutely. So the Army actually has this funny joke on social media, where they have this award. It's the medal for the war on excess, and has quite a few campaign stars, which is very comical, but it's actually very true for a number of reasons. But historically, the Army's had gatherings, meetings of hundreds of people representing all major commands for equipping. They bring thousands of sheets of paper with future authorizations, future transfers, all listed manually on a piece of paper that these hundreds of people have to sit a big conference room, sit around and discuss by LIN, by NIN, by serial number, what's going where and the dates of such. Very inefficient. So in the 2010s, the Army decided to create a tool to deconflict that. When they created this tool in the early stages, it was called something different, but they found a lot of redundancy. One truck would be slated to go 3 different locations from one losing command, and that's because of the inefficiencies of paperwork and manual tracking. So they created this tool that identified all the redundancies, it deleted the redundancies, and it found there's about 980,000 pieces of equipment excess in the Army, excess as defined by above the authorization, whether it's an MTO or TDA for a specific UIC. So with this magic number, 980K, that number became important because in 2016 and in 2017, 980K sites were stood up across the Army. And these 980K sites closely resemble the 14 MDRS locations we see right now. So in 2016, 2017, AMC stood up 980K locations, which were just locations where excess pieces of equipment after they get dispositioned can go to expedite the process of getting to the next location they need to go to. Well, in 2017 to 2022, or 2020, they rebranded as All Army Excess. Essentially the same thing, but it kind of branched out more with these All Army Excess to where now you can bring your location and you don't even have to have funding. It's almost like a consolidation point. And in that time period, around 2019, the idea of the Modernization, Displacement, and Repair site came about. I was lucky enough to actually serve at my current location with the lieutenant colonel and retired civilian who were both majors at the time when they created this. And MDRS was created in 19, tested in Fort Cavazos, and then put into place in 2020. So since 2020, we've had MDRS. After that, in 2023, R2E came about from Forces Command, who said we need a quicker way to get rid of our equipment. And that brings us to where we are now, where R2E is going away and MDRS is expiring.
Wow. So we're all this work, we went through all these different processes, and now I was like, you know what? We're done. We're going to try something new.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, we'll get more into it later, but every effort, right, 980K, All Army Excess, MDRS, R2E, you can measure their success. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's just good for the audience because I know a lot of people have heard the term 980K constantly, but it's just neat to know now that that's kind of where that came from, is your 980,000 excess. So it's a neat thing to think about because, like, I never knew that. I know a lot of people just hear that term and just no idea where it came from, but now it's good to see that we do know where it came from now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to see, you know, that the Army's been trying to tackle this, you know, at least since the 2010s, recognizing that there is a ton of stuff. Like, I know through my Army crew, we opened up containers and it's just full of stuff that's never touched, that's been in there for God knows how long. And now we'd be able to have a process to get to alleviate the units of that, because there's stuff on property books people are still inventorying that should not be inventoried. So we kind of talked about, you introduced it, you know, the R2E, the MDRS, 980K, and we kind of like the little story behind that now. And then you just talked about how it's kind of going away. Can you tell us more about, like, the impact that MDRS had and R2E?
Absolutely. So MDRS, upon its inception, was supposed to be a modernization site, a displacement site, a repair site. As it came about, it was quickly found to be infeasible for the MDRS to be a feeder point for the installations they support for all of their modernization. As it came out that commands and commanders did not like that choke point being unnecessarily placed upon them when, say, you get the new M88, right? The new 88 comes out, it's an A2, you've been waiting for it. Well, now the 88 has to go to the modernization point first. They have to take control, like, maintain of it, to get it, physically store it, get the paperwork, get it on their property books from the PM shop. And then training can occur with your unit who needs it, who wants it. It ended up not being the best idea. So they stopped being the modernization points. Repair was the same way. It turns out repair is extremely expensive because these repair sites units can pay the MDRS site to conduct maintenance that they're not capable of conducting themselves. But as it turns out, it's too expensive to run, and there's not enough maintenance contractors that we could put on payroll to support what the units wanted to do. So those repair contracts also quickly fell out of popularity, and they were let to expire. So they no longer did repair at all. As a matter of fact, there's very few. I believe there's 3 or 4 remaining with repair contracts before R2E began. So then they became the displacement sites. But the MDRS being the displacement sites, they're very good at one thing, which is receiving equipment from the installation they support to give immediate property book relief. They did that very well. There's some choke points from a policy perspective that we'll talk about in a minute with MDRS. But that's how MDRS came to where it is. And then, sorry, I'm trying to apply this to R2E. R2E
was an HQDA program from General George, based off ForceCom's feedback, and it alleviated and streamlined some processes, and it is now going away because of the expiration date built into it when it was published, along with, believe it or not, Forces Command is heading the charge to get rid of R2E, because the person who benefits the most from the R2E program is Forces Command, but also the person who has harmed the most thus far has also been Forces Command from the policy change. And Forces Command has been the one leading the charge with ANC, going back to HQDA to not add R2E into policy and actually phase it out.
Wow. So kind of before we get into like it being phased out, the policy behind all that, when it was, you know, in its workforce, like when it was being implemented, what would the process be like for a unit going through MDRS and R2E? How'd that look for them to get rid of excess?
Absolutely. So going through MDRS is a routine process that we've been doing since 2020. It's essentially you have your disposition, right? And your disposition is what's commonly referred to as a PSD. So when people say PSD, they're typically talking about that printout instruction from the DST system of, hey, you've got a Humvee on Fort Cavazos that's going to Fort Carson. Okay, cool. Well, I'm at Fort Cavazos. I obviously can't drive it to Fort Carson, or I don't want to. It's got a pass-through to the MDRS. Okay, so I'm going to take this piece of equipment to the MDRS. They're going to inspect it per the disposition instructions that are printed and transportability standards, because they have to put it on flatbed. And then they're going to accept that piece of equipment, and they're going to induct it, and you're going to PGI it in GCSS, and they're going to PGR, and then it's off your hander seat. And it's good, and you don't have to think about it anymore. So that's how MDRS worked. And then later behind the scenes, the MDRS would put in the FUVA for the transportation funds. They would wait for approval. They would do the coordination with the transportation service provider. They would get it. They would ship it. And they would be the one who has to hound the gaining unit to get it off their property book. Now, what R2E did is it essentially, at the Army policy level, said, we are going to mandate that these are the only pieces of equipment, these are the only pieces of supporting documentation that will be required at every location in the Army to process these transfers. And what we found is that was actually needed, because there was a certain corps in the Army who took R2E and they ran with it. And they bolted off the start line and they capitalized on R2E. They got a ton of equipment processed. There was another corps in the Army who took a few months to fully get on board with R2E. And what we found is that by the Army saying, this is it, only these five documents are required, we found that there were our own worst enemies, ourselves. We were enforcing different standards at different locations, right? Different divisions, different corps, different ACOMs. Everyone had a different standard, so it was confusing. And some of those standards were, in the eyes of the policymakers at the time, unnecessary, legacy, and not required. And it took HQDA and Forces Command, along with us at Army Sustainment Command on behalf of AMC, to work with a lot of high-up multi-star commands to say, that doesn't jive with what General George has directed for R2E. You can't ask that anymore. And by us flattening those lines of communication with everyone across the Army, at least the continental United States, it became much easier for units to use the MDRS. And that's not to say that R2E was exclusive to MDRS, because it's not. There's multiple camps posted installations across the world that utilize R2E without MDRS every single day. But that's kind of how you would use MDRS, and there's quite a few steps in between there, but that's the gist of it, and that's how R2E streamlined the use of the supply system, along with the use of the supply system through an MDRS location.
All right. Yeah, I know we keep talking about, and we keep hinting about that the policy and regulation is doctrine that governs all this. I know you just kind of alluded to it, like how we streamlined it, because everybody was trying to put their own requirements on it, which kind of bottlenecks everything. So can you kind of walk us through specifically what governs all this? And how you already alluded to, this is coming down from General George, it helped get rid of that bottlenecking from people putting their own requirements on it. But what is the official guidance? What is the official regulation and policy?
So there's quite a few. I'm going to kind of step back before I list off the specific regulations to say that common sense always prevails. If you're a PBO and you don't know anything about maintenance or transportation, you can't supply very well. And all three of those functions are integral to supply. Supply is a broad term, and we have to understand how to read maintenance documents and how to coordinate transportation funds and equipment. So with that, you've got supply regulations along with maintenance regulations. So for transfers and turn-ins, you've got AR 710-4, which has recently been revamped. And there's a lot of smart people who have revamped it. And it's been brought into the current generation. CW5 Greg Bisaw is very active on social media. He's a big advocate on many supply pages. He was a major author in 710-4. And it all makes sense. Believe it or not, the Army's supply system makes perfect sense when you understand it and you look at it. And it coincides with 750-1. So AR 750-1 is the maintenance document to outline transfer standards maintenance-wise. So you cannot have a supply transfer without some sort of understanding of the mechanical condition the equipment has to be in, right? And the standard is 1020. And people may or may not like that, but the standard is there for a reason. And the reason, there's always a reason behind all this. And like I said, common sense always prevails. And if you just read the regulations and you're not interpreting them to understand them, you're doing yourself a disservice. But the reason equipment has to be good, I'm going to use that term in lieu of 1020 or condition code A or whatever you want to call it, right? If it's on your books, right, that means you're authorized the equipment. Unless you're not, which means it's become excess. But if it's on your books, you're being paid by Congress to the Army by your authorization, maintenance funds, it's called trim dollars. You're paid to keep that piece of equipment at 1020 standard. The reason you don't want excess is because you're not being paid to maintain that piece of equipment. So if it becomes excess, you need to get rid of it. If another unit has it, does not have that piece of equipment, I should say, they're being paid to maintain it when they don't have it, right? So if you're being paid to maintain it, you must maintain it. There's a lot of reasons to go into that. That's how policy works, right? All of the reasons that you're coming up with, or, you know, we all think of back in our lieutenant years or our command years, like, why have an FTX and this and that? Policy can't plan for that. You must maintain it. And when you transfer, you have to give it at a 1020 level standard, because again, you're paid to maintain, you're not paid to overhaul. So if you give a junk Humvee from Alpha Company to Bravo Company, now Bravo Company can't overhaul that, because that's not how the system is made, how the maintenance system is made, how maintenance dollars are allocated. They're not paid to completely overhaul it. And that doesn't meet 750-1 transfer requirements. And that doesn't meet the 710-4 property requirements that reference 750-1. And the reason to everything is always money. And the reason 1020 maintenance standards exist is because money. But those are two of the biggest ones. There's tons. 770-2 references cascading equipment fleets, which is another type of transfer of property. It's big. It's huge. Those are tracked by brigades at the four-star level across the whole Army. But for everyday usage, 710-4 and 750-1 are your best friends, and they do make sense at the policy level.
So you're telling me that the simple answers and everything, all you have to do is read the regulation. It's going to tell us how to do everything.
I laugh at it too, because when I was a lieutenant, I couldn't stand those field grade officers sitting around saying, oh, read the regulation. Well, now I'm sitting up here reading the regulation. I'm like, well, you should read the regulations.
It's as simple as that.
It is. It's actually a superpower. There's a joke in our office. If you just read the regulation, you're a superhero.
I mean, it's true. I think in your younger years, you're like, oh, we can figure this out. We don't need to do that. And then complain why something's not getting done. But the answer is literally already written for us in the regulation. And that's just a great point to highlight, just, you know, especially when it comes to the turn-in process and all this. Get into those regulations, get into them, and they're going to help walk you through it step by step on how to ensure that your equipment is efficiently processed through the turn-in process. You're not going to get all these delayed. I know you're starting to allude on some of the condition codes, the 1020 and stuff. There's a lot of misconceptions out there. Question comes like 1020, what these condition codes, what they are, you know, who decides them. I guess the first thing to hit on is like, what specifically makes something 1020? Like people hear that standard all the time and they're like, well, it has to be 1020 standard. And of course, someone who doesn't get into the regulation, if someone doesn't get in the regulation, of course, they're not going to know. But what's the down and dirty, I guess, Cliff Notes version of what 1020 is or what it means?
Absolutely. Yeah. So 1020, if we're speaking in basic terms, it has to have all of its 10 and 20 level services complete, up to date. And there's some nuances with, you know, like artillery pieces and some winterization of other stuff. But the gist of it is it has to be in fully working condition. There's nothing wrong with it. All of its services are up to date. And it's not, how do I say this? It's FMC, right? It's fully mission capable. It's up to date with its services. That's the gist of what 1020 means. It's working just fine. You've done a TI, there's nothing wrong with it, you didn't catch, and all the services are up to date. That's the most basic layman's term of 1020. Now, you can look at AR 750-1 paragraph 4-9 for much more elaboration on that. And it goes into the specifics that I talked about earlier as far as like aircraft, gun tubes. But that's the gist of it.
It's got to be able to get there on its own power. You can't sit there and push it in and say, yeah, we're good.
That is absolutely not 1020. Well, it's up to date on surfaces. Yeah, but the oil just leaked out. That doesn't count.
That's the thing. I know that gets units all the time, especially sometimes it comes to funding, because there's a struggle. It's like, we need the funding to be able to get the 1020 so we can turn in. It feels like sometimes that can be like a revolving door or this twilight zone you're just stuck in. I need money to fix it, to get it out of here, to get it off my books.
I'm so glad you brought that up. There's a gentleman in my office who says the truth has a date timestamp on it. And that's very true. Right. Everything is subjective, right? You get it to 1020, right? Your maintenance chief says, hey, this is 1020. Your supply folks verify, hey, it's 1020. It's even got all of its BII. It has no shortages. And you ship it to the next installation. Well, guess what? It's up to them to decide if it meets their subjective 1020 standards. So everything's subjective and it comes down to communication at the end of the day.
So now we kind of just talked about some of the 1020s, you know. What about these condition codes? We hear this all the time. You said condition code alpha before, code F or whatever. There's just so many different things out there. And I know there's a lot of people who have no idea what these codes mean or where they even come from.
Absolutely. So you have equipment condition codes, right? You've got supply condition codes and you have maintenance condition codes. Obviously, they're two different things, but they are clearly defined. You've got to differentiate, number one, what are you talking about? Are you talking about supply condition code or a maintenance condition code? When you're looking at a piece of equipment, think of it this way, right? If I'm asking you for a condition code or the disposition of the piece of equipment, if it's broken, I'm definitely not going to send it to someone else. If it's good, I'm going to send it to someone else who needs it.
So I need the supply condition code to discern what mechanical condition it's in that corresponds with that supply condition code. And you can look these up really easily on Google. If you just look up Army supply condition codes, the first thing that's going to pop up is actually going to be a DLA website. And they have an easy access. Click on it. It's going to tell you A through Z or whatever it is it stops at. And that DLA website has what each one needs. So with that supply condition code, you can go forward with the discernation of where the equipment needs to go. And that's important for a number of reasons, right? You've got a Humvee. Everybody's authorized Humvees. And, you know, I know we're transitioning to JLTVs, but for the sake of argument, let's just use Humvee, right? I've got a Humvee in Bravo company of whatever battalion, whatever brigade. It's broke. That thing is down. It is, Jimmy's been struggling with it for a few years and it's dead in the water. Well, you need to do a TI, and everyone
dislikes that, but because, well, we know it's broke. I know you know it's broke, but you've got a lot of people sitting in offices right down the street from you at your battalion, right down the road at your brigade, across the installation at your division, across installations at your corps, and across the U.S. at your ACOM level,
that don't see that item every day. So you have to do a TI to support that supply condition code listings, specifically what's wrong with the vehicle.
Because again, the people you're sending this paperwork to can't see that Humvee. They don't know that, oh, you know, bumper number 555 has been dead for years. Why can't we get rid of it? Well, they don't know because they're not part of your organization. They don't see it every day. So that's the importance of filling it out correctly. Additionally, 750-1 restricts the unit's capability that they cannot discern a NMC condition code of H or P. H is condemned. P is also condemned reclamation. But you as a unit, you can't claim it's actually dead. You have to make a claim and then it must be verified by an LCMC, life cycle management command. That's common their TACOM, AMCOM, CCOM. An LCMC LAR has to confirm that, or a sustainment level maintenance representative, which has a broad definition. So like think if it's something that needs to be calibrated, like a chemical set, radiation detection, and it can't be calibrated, your TMDE shop is a sustainment level verification that if you get them to sign off on that DA-7273 that it can't be calibrated any longer, congratulations, you've just verified that it's actually unserviceable. And you get all that information just by reading a few lines in 750-1 and 710-4. So it's dead in the water. You've got your paperwork.
Based off the condition code that makes sense, the supply condition code, right? So that Humvee is unserviceable. It's condition code H. You send that paperwork up to your higher organization who's never seen the paperwork. They see it. It makes sense to them. Okay, this is an unserviceable Humvee. It's verified by an LCMC. We're going to send that to DLA. Or maybe it is serviceable, but nobody needs it. We're going to send that Humvee to Red River instead.
And here's the funny thing, just as a tangent, if it's a turn into depot or if it's a turn into DLA, it's always been as is. R2E didn't change that at all. R2E had nothing to do with depot or DLA turn ins, nothing to do at all. If it is serviceable and it's condition code B, B, C, D, E, F, each of those has a different definition. Those condition codes are important to understand what the condition code is. If it's condition code B, like it's basically brand new. It's not condition code A unless it comes out of the depot, but you'll get that that discernation from the condition code you look at. And if it's in a serviceable condition, we can keep that piece of equipment in the Army and transfer it to someone who actually needs it, wherever that may be. But that's like the importance of condition codes, the two different types, supply and maintenance, and kind of like, again, like the common sense walking through like, hey, for a supply transaction, I need to know mechanically what condition it's in, so I'm not taking a broke Humvee and sending it to a unit who needs a Humvee.
Thank you very much for that discussion on the condition codes, because I know that can trip people up so much on specifically what the condition codes mean. I think it goes back to the simple thing, get the regulation. Like, if you don't know what this condition code is, one, it's a simple Google search away, but more importantly, just get into the regulation so you can have understanding when you get this piece of equipment, you get back the TI and understand, okay, so the condition code is, this is where it's at, but also understand, okay, this piece of equipment says that, or the paperwork says, we need this to be condition code, whatever, it might be at a different condition code, what you need to go through to get that, to get it back up and running. And sometimes I know that can take some time. That's something the units can struggle with because like, well, it's not up to standard. It's not 1020 now. So I know we just kind of talked about that, but understanding what condition codes mean and how to get that equipment up to 1020 is going to make you more efficient at getting this excess turned in. So really appreciate you walking us through that, because that's something that trips people up all the time.
We've just barely scratched the surface with this conversation on the war in excess. We have so much more to discuss as we look to find the solutions to more efficient property management across the board. Be sure to tune in next week for part two as I continue the conversation with Major Shackelford on the ways ahead for these programs in excess. I can promise you, you won't want to miss it. As always, sustainment leaders start here. See you next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Logstat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on Global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn at Army Sustainment. We'll see you next time. Sustainment leaders start here.